Final seconds of the game. A chance to score, and the chance has gone begging. If your business's commerce platform keeps missing the target on golden opportunities, get the MVP you deserve. Get Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whether you're a garage entrepreneur or IPO ready, Shopify is the only tool that you need to start, run, and grow your business without the struggle. Shopify puts you in control of every sales channel. So whether you're selling signed football boots from Shopify's in-person POS system or you're vending vintage shirts on Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform, you are covered. And once you've reached your audience, Shopify has the internet's best converting checkout to help you turn them from browsers to buyers. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is truly a global force, powering Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across over 170 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ranks, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ranks to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/ranks.
Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite football podcast. Back for another week, back in the middle of a Champions League week, which means we're going to do something a little bit more evergreen today, so it doesn't go out of date really, really quickly. My name is Jack Collins, and I'll be your host there. I'm joined, as ever, by my co-host, our transfer guru, Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, very good, mate. Very good. It's been a busy morning here on Tuesday. Liverpool finally starting to get themselves in gear for what comes next after Jurgen Klopp. So the news breaking today about Michael Edwards coming back into the club and that Richard Hughes will be coming in as a sporting director at the club as they look to restructure. And I think it's really interesting, mate, about, you know, the next era of the Premier League, because that's kind of what we're gearing up to now. We all saw at the weekend what is probably the last ever Klopp v Guardiola encounter.
In the Premier League, at least. It was brilliant, wasn't it? It was great.
Yeah. The last ever Premier League meeting before between those two was a corker. And obviously, we've broken all that down on Patreon. So go over there and do have a listen if you want to go back over that game, because we did a lot of detail on that on Monday. But now I'm already in the mindset of, okay, well, what comes next? Because the big thing for Liverpool was to have Michael Edwards or whoever that was going to be in place so that they could then get on with the managerial appointment. And also, of course, they've got those contract situations to sort out around Salah and Van Dijk and Trent and all the rest of it. So this is really important to get the ball rolling. And it actually got my mind ticking as to what we're going to be getting next season. So the thing I love is the new look management in the Premier League next season. Because, yeah, Man City will still have Pep, Arsenal will still have Mikel Arteta, and Tottenham will still have Ange Postecoglou. But there are some big changes coming next season. Liverpool, obviously, like front runners at the moment to compete with Bayern Munich for Xabi Alonso. And as I sit here right now, are continuing to go for him, have a reasonable level of confidence that their offer will be a good one that he will be intrigued by and interested in. Might even take the job. And then you've got Amorim and Nagelsmann as the kind of background contenders if that one doesn't come through. But Chelsea, Pochettino's job, definitely not safe for next season. And at the moment, you've got the likes of Hansi Flick, Ruben Amorim being talked about as people that could be in charge of Chelsea next season. At Man United, Erik ten Hag's job, definitely not safe for next season. Graham Potter and Gareth Southgate, the latest names being talked about for Man United next season. over at Newcastle United, Eddie Howe, definitely not safe for next season. Newcastle, now 10th in the Premier League and facing an ominous FA Cup tie at the weekend against Manchester City. And if they lose that, he's ending the season trophyless and potentially mid-table. And I think in that situation, loses his job. And we get, I don't know, Jose Mourinho rocking up at Newcastle United. Who knows who they could appoint? Beyond that, West Ham United, David Moyes. Definitely not sure to be at West Ham as manager next season. Who could come in? Thomas Tuchel, perhaps. Like, mate, this, it just kind of got my brain ticking this morning as to, you know, what we're getting going forward in the Premier League. Because, yes, it's kind of sad that this Klopp era has come to an end. I say kind of sad because I don't mean that for Liverpool fans. It's very sad for them. But even in the general football world, like, it's been so enthralling, everything that he's brought to the Premier League. But I was like, it's okay. There's a new chapter and it's still going to be wild and fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting, isn't it? And to be honest, I think that we talked about it a little bit a few weeks ago, but that managerial merry-go-round is very much not stopping. And last year, we didn't really have that. There were obviously the odd move here and there, but there wasn't huge amounts of change, I think, at the biggest guns. We're talking, you know, but you can add Bayern Munich and obviously Barcelona to this list as well. And then you kind of come to, well, are Juventus going to get a new manager? Is Max Allegri going to be in charge of Juve next year? My hunch is no. But, you know, all of those things might trigger other bits and bobs as well. And I suppose my one caveat in terms of excitement is that I am still a little bit concerned that Marco Silva has done an excellent job at Fulham and someone might take a punt.
West Ham are interested, I understand, mate.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that, but you know, that's one where you go, okay, West Ham are a bigger club than Fulham, absolutely no doubt. But when you look at what's going on in these two clubs, is there all that much scope for moving sideways or a little bit up to try and push upwards again, or is he going to hold on for one of these bigger jobs? The other thing is that I think Benfica will probably be looking for a new manager this series, and under Roger Schmidt, obviously, if they win the league, that turns things around a little bit. But it hasn't been a good year for Benfica. If Amorim is pinched by someone, then Sporting are going to be looking for a new manager. I kind of wonder, given how the season's gone at Porto, if they're going to be looking for a new manager as well. So we could have all change in the Portuguese big three. That knocks on into different categories. And as you kind of look at these, it's one thing being like, oh, okay, cool. There's going to be new managers at, let's say, five big clubs. But then it also goes, okay, well, if someone's going to be there, there is going to be interest in Simone Inzaghi, because what he's done at Inter has been absolutely phenomenal. Inter should be doing everything in their possible power to sign him to a new contract right now, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But if those offers start landing from the big guns, then there is going to be a sense of, okay, could we end up with, you know, 10 managers changing next summer in clubs that you're going to be noticing there to be a notable change? Borussia Dortmund, Edin Terzic's job fundamentally not safe there either. So
yeah.
I think that there's a lot to like and there's a lot to be excited about. But, you know, you started this with Liverpool and it makes sense, I think, to come back there. This turnaround in that Michael Edwards at one point was very much not interested in returning to the club and now seems to be taking an even more senior role and basically in charge of the entire restructure in this post-Klopp era, I think is one, incredibly smart from FSG and Liverpool. The two hails this kind of idea of, oh, what are we getting next? Because this could be very, very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. This is very clear thinking from Liverpool. And also, you know, I think that Richard Hughes joining Edwards is very interesting. And I'm told that there was a pretty good chance that wherever Edwards decided to go next, that Hughes was actually going to be following him. So it's quite a coup that for Liverpool, because in enticing Edwards back to the club, they've also managed to get Hughes, who is very much respected in the football world in terms of that sort of role. So yeah, big job for them now, though. You know, this is a very new age thing. I tweeted this today, like, didn't used to get, you know, in the old days, you wouldn't write barely anything about like changes at that level. They wouldn't really get reported. People didn't get excited really about upstairs appointments. But in modern football, it does make headlines, and the knock-on effect is felt, and obviously we probably hear more than ever about the financials and how deals come about and all that kind of thing. So it is important. But the thing people really care about is who's going to replace Jurgen Klopp. And that's the big test now. Can they lure Xavi Alonso over to Anfield and make sure that they make this as seamless as possible? Because otherwise, there's always that danger you could fall off a cliff. And Liverpool do not want that happening after everything that Klopp has built.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's going to happen, because I think that there is a structure and a feeling in place around Liverpool that makes it more difficult for things to fall off. He's not being left, or whoever this next manager is not being left with a really aging squad that's been, you know, that every drop has been squeezed out of. It feels like there is fresh blood incoming. There is talent in the ranks, and there's a lot of players here who have come in relatively recently who still have quite a lot to prove, I think, in a Liverpool shirt. And that's a cool place. But the flip side of that is, if you're Xabi Alonso, and, you know, I think that there is, you know, you said a couple of weeks ago that you would be absolutely stunned if he wasn't the next Liverpool manager. I think maybe that feeling has reeled back a little bit from where we were a couple of weeks ago. I think after the Klopp news, it felt almost impossible that they wouldn't end up with Xabi Alonso in the dugout next year. But equally, I do think there is a sense that he is a relatively sensible and head screwed on character here. He will understand that replacing a legend at clubs often doesn't go well for the next person that comes in. Obviously, you look at Moyes at Manchester United. Yes, okay, slightly poison chalice in terms of the squad that he was left with, but all the same. You look at when, you know, Emery replaced Arsene Wenger at Arsenal. There were, and that wasn't even a going out on a massive high. There was a lot of chat about whether Arsene Wenger had come to the end of his tenure. And yet Emery, again, squad problems, but couldn't quite turn things around to get everyone going again at Arsenal. It's not an easy job walking into somewhere after someone has had this much success and been able to turn around an entire club. And I think when you look at where Bayern are, there's a feeling, I suppose, that whilst Bayern, you have to win, it's non-negotiable, right? And that's fine. There is also a sense that everything in the club is a bit up in the air, a little bit wishy-washy at the moment. And whilst that can present its own problems, I think Alonso would be able to go in there and instill something quite new far more easily than perhaps he could at Liverpool. And that's probably worth considering. The other thing about this is that Xabi Alonso once turned down Borussia Mönchengladbach to stay with Real Sociedad's B team. He turned down big offers before in order to stick around in one, the Real Madrid academies and learn his trade there. And then obviously Al Real as well. I kind of do think that there is a possibility that didn't seem maybe feasible a few months ago, even that Xabi Alonso might just be like, I'm actually really good here at Leverkusen. I'm building something. I might be able to build it out for a little bit longer. Now, I know it's hard to turn down the emotional pull, especially when you have attachments to both of these clubs in the way that he does with both Bayern and more specifically, I think, Liverpool. But there is a part of me that thinks maybe he just goes, you know what? Everything's pretty good here. Maybe I just stick around and do a year.
And at the end of that,
the Real Madrid job probably comes up because Ancelotti goes one more year probably.
I just can't see it. When you've got two clubs like this over you, it's very rare that you would make that choice or even be left with that choice because of the amount of money and the push that is made to come and get you. I would struggle to see if Xavi Alonso wins a Bundesliga with Bayer Leverkusen, I'd struggle to see what the motivation is to stay in Germany, either with Leverkusen or with Bayern. I would be like, we can go and win the Champions League with Liverpool. You know, I think there's more motivation to then come to England if he does. If he comes up short, if suddenly, I don't know, like, what does this change? What if Bayern, this won't happen. What if Bayern were to reel Leverkusen in this season, close the 10-point gap, pip Leverkusen to the title, and then take Xabi Alonso over to Bayern Munich for next season? I don't know. Like, I don't know how I feel about that either, however unlikely it is. But yeah, look, this is going to rattle on, but it will also intensify now. That's why I wanted to talk about it just at the start of the show today, because it is a tug of war to get Xabi Alonso, but it also kickstarts what's to come next season. And, you know, Man United will probably be in the background for a little bit here. They're making structural changes of their own. They've got their own managerial situation to sort out.
I thought you meant in the background for Xabi Alonso. I was like, he just won't do that.
And that's all going to be overshadowed at the moment because Liverpool are leaving in the shadows at the moment. And that's why United's managerial appointment, if they do decide to move on from Ten Hag, is going to be even more important to get right. Because if you get that one wrong, you're suddenly stuck behind Liverpool for even more years.
Yeah, definitely. It's going to be a very interesting summer. All right, we've gone from looking forwards to slightly looking backwards in part two. We're going to be looking at the greatest European goal scorers of all time. I'm talking about our favourite ones. Something a little bit different, a little bit looser, but we're excited to get into it. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where it's time for our main segment, an evergreen segment on the greatest goal scorers in European Cup history. We're going to look through the list, pick out some of our favourites and talk about them in a little bit more depth. DJ, this was your idea. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of came onto my radar last week because Erling Haaland propelled himself into the top 20 European goal scorers of all time. And by that, I mean neither the European Cup or, as it's now known, the Champions League. And by scoring in Manchester City's last Champions League match, he put himself on 41 European goals, which actually is already level with Manchester City legend Sergio Aguero. Aguero took 79 games to get to 41 goals. Haaland has taken 37. He's done this in like half the amount of games that Aguero did. So it was that kind of triggered. I was like, okay, that's cool. So he's like in the top 20 now, Erling Haaland. What is the top 20? Who are the 20 European goal-scoring goats that we all need to know and be comparing this guy to? Because Haaland has got to the top 20 in 37 games, and there is every chance that over the course of this guy's career, he ends up competing at very least to be the best ever and taking that number one spot. So it's going to be fascinating, obviously, to see where Haaland ends up over the course of his career, like what other teams he goes on to play for. I do believe that he's loving life at Manchester City. I don't believe that this is the only club he's ever going to play for in the Champions League. And whether it's Real Madrid or Barcelona, who knows? But he's going to score a lot more goals in this competition. And he's already been pulling up trees by just setting records left, right and centre, hasn't he? You know, every time, every single season so far in Erling Haaland's career, he's been ripping up records for how quickly he has been reaching landmark moments. So there's a lot more to come from this guy. But yeah, I thought this is a good starting point to start the list in that Sergio Aguero and Erling Haaland are at joint 19th in the list. So I'm going to run up from there and we're going to go through to number one. And that's the official list. Those are the best European goal scorers of all time. There's no doubt about that because the stats say so, right? But then on the back of that, I want me and you to rank our three favourites. Who are our favourite goal scorers from this European period? And yeah, just have a bit of a chat around it and have a bit of fun because we're allowed to have our favourites. They don't necessarily have to be one, two and three in the list of how many goals they've actually scored. It's all about stylistic preferences, what you like to see in your forwards and what's really caught your eye across their own careers. So just to start running through it, as I say, 19 is Haaland and Aguero. At number 18, Alessandro Del Piero, who done it at Juventus, like an incredible period from 1995 to 2009 at Juve. He's on 42 goals, so he will be caught by Haaland. At number 17, there's Neymar at Barcelona and PSG. He got onto 43 goals. At number 15, we've got two guys. Mohamed Salah and Didier Drogba both have 44 European goals. Drogba can't get any more. Mo Salah can. So we'll see him creeping up this list further and further. Drogba doing it at Marseille, Chelsea and Galatasaray. Salah doing it at Basel, Chelsea and Roma before, of course, getting to Liverpool. Then officially at number 12, because these guys are all joined for 46 goals. You've got the great Eusebio, someone that none of us ever saw him play. But we know he was a great man. He was at Benfica. Between 1961 and 1974, he scored his 46 goals in 65 games. A similar record to the one Kylian Mbappe has right now from his time at Monaco and PSG. He's got 46 goals and he's taken actually four more matches to do so than Eusebio did.
Eusebio Goat, is that what we're saying?
Yeah, it might be, mate, might be. And Filippo Inzaghi comes in two on 46 goals. It took him 81 matches during his spells with Juve and AC Milan. And now we go into the top 10. Zlatan Ibrahimovic and Andrei Shevchenko both have 48 goals in European football. Zlatan travelled Europe to do it. He did it at Ajax, Juventus, Inter Milan, Barcelona, AC Milan, PSG and Man United. That's where his 48 goals came from. Absolutely incredible the way that
he's great vibes, isn't it?
Moved around and continued to do it right. Yeah, didn't actually score one for Man United, but did play for him in the Champions League. Took him 124 matches to score those 48 goals, though. So his ratio in terms of goals per game, the second lowest, I believe, in this list of the top 20. Andrei Shevchenko scored his 48 in 100 matches for Dinamo Kiev, AC Milan and Chelsea. At number nine, another player that we definitely never saw live, but definitely do know who he is, Alfredo Di Stefano, the Real Madrid legend. He got 49 goals in 58 appearances up to 1964. Even I wasn't behind the goal to see Di Stefano banging them in.
It's him and Holland, though, isn't it, in terms of goals a game? That's unbelievable.
Yes, 0.84, his ratio is, which is... extremely high. In fact, when you look at the top 20 names that we talk about here, Di Stefano has the second best record. Only Haaland actually has a better ratio for goals per game than him. So that is actually, you're right, that is really impressive and underlines that things aren't necessarily better these days. There are some lads that could have squeezed into the modern game and continue to bang them in. At number eight, Thierry Henry, Monaco, Arsenal, Barcelona, 112 matches, 50 goals. So again, not an outstanding goals per game ratio, but we should probably remember Thierry Henry was slightly different from your natural goal scorer. We're going to talk about him a bit more in a minute. At number seven, a close friend of the rank squad, Thomas Müller. Here he is, number seven, the horse himself, Bayern Munich legend.
The Bavarian horse.
54 goals for Thomas Müller in 149 games. Absolute legend of the game. At number six, Ruud van Nistelrooy. 56 goals for him across his time at PSV Eindhoven, Manchester United and Real Madrid. Into the top five. These are the guys that really are the GOATs. Number five, Raul, Real Madrid and Schalke, don't forget. Yeah, 71 European goals. There's a big jump here from Ruud van Nistelrooy into the top five where you get Raul. 142 matches for him. Absolute crazy footballer. Again, one we'll probably talk about a bit more in a minute. Number four, Karim Benzema. Lyon and then on to Real Madrid. 90 goals. Got 19 more goals than Raul in only 10 more appearances. Fantastic record for Karim Benzema. Somebody that does have a better ratio, though, Robert Lewandowski. He's in at number three. Borussia Dortmund, Bayern Munich, Barcelona, doesn't matter where he is, continues to score goals. 93 goals from 117 games. 0.79 is his ratio. Very impressive stuff from Lewandowski. And in fact, that is the same goals per game ratio as the guy at number two, little Leo himself. Leo Messi has scored 129 goals from 163 appearances for Barcelona and PSG in a spell from 2005 to 2023. And at number one is Cristiano Ronaldo. He'll be very pleased to be on top of the pile, of course. From Manchester United to Real Madrid to Juventus, he did do it best. His ratio was 0.77. He scored 140 goals from 183 appearances. So he is the guy that Haaland has got to try to catch if he's going to...
He's only got 100 to go.
...this list. So there's a bit of work to do. But seeing as Haaland's got about 10 years to do it, there's every chance, probably longer to be honest, there's every chance he can get there. So yeah, Cristiano Ronaldo sits at the top of the list, 11 goals clear of Leo Messi. It's brilliant to remember these guys. I think that's what I liked doing. I mean, we'll all have different memories of these guys. Depends obviously what age you are and what stage you started watching your football. But, you know, if there's any of these guys that you haven't heard of, like, go and watch some goals, man. Like, all of these 20 goal scorers are just ridiculous, ridiculous footballers.
Yeah, I mean, two questions before we get into it. One, Erling Haaland, to overtake Cristiano Ronaldo, needs 100 more goals, right, in the Champions League. Now, it's going to change, obviously. There's going to be more games in the Champions League next year, so it's worth bearing that in mind. But that would mean that if he'd say, you know, as you said, 10 years, probably a little bit more, but he'd have to average 10 goals a season in the Champions League for 10 years to get to that. That is incredible. That's an incredible amount of goals to still have to score. And it kind of fits in nicely with his second question, which is Robert Lewandowski on 93. You'd suggest that maybe he has one more year, plus obviously Barcelona, well, playing tonight. By the time you listen to this, he might have added a few more to that tally. My question was going to be, do you think he gets to the 100? Do you? Because I actually don't. I don't think he gets there. I reckon when Robert Lewandowski leaves Barcelona. Okay, well, let me rephrase that. I think he doesn't get there at Barcelona. Now, yeah, I don't know what the next club looks like or what that next step is for him. But I don't think that we see him score. If he scored a hat trick tonight, this is going to look so dumb. But I don't think he gets to 100 at Barcelona.
Yeah, that's slightly different because even when Lewandowski does leave Barcelona, I would still expect him to be playing Champions League football. He's 35 now. I'd say, you know, if say he's got three more years in him to get seven goals.
Yeah, maybe he goes to like Milan, replaces Olivier Giroud when he decides to hang up the boots.
This is the thing. He's only got to take that sort of role within another setup. And I think if he was to go to Serie A, or I don't know, maybe another team. Maybe goes back to Dortmund. I don't know. Could do.
Yeah, maybe. I don't see it.
Nor do I. But you know, weirder things have happened. I can see him getting there. But yeah, I think Haaland is definitely going to be helped by the fact that this new Champions League format is going to give him more opportunities to score against teams that aren't that good. In his
maybe.
World.
I mean, the new system does actually, well, you play two games against a team that, you know, bottom of your group anyway. Right now, you're only playing two games against teams from the bottom pot anyway. So I don't think it necessarily stretches that out all that much. But yeah, I think the more games is the crucial point here. The more games you get, the more goals that Erling Haaland is going to score. And it really is as simple as that in so many ways.
Yeah. Obviously, we know that this guy wants to become the best in the world. We know that this is a player whose aim at the end of his career is to have more goals than games to his name. He started at a rate that is definitely going to make that possible. But Ronaldo has been immense, and we, you know, whether you like him or not, you can't take away from him his reliability for goals. It's been absolutely relentless, and it's been hugely impressive. And at the moment, you know, we're seeing Haaland, I don't want to say struggle, but he's not finding the goals as easy to come by on a week-by-week basis for Manchester City. So there's going to be times when he's got to lift himself and make sure that he can maintain this level of competition for Ronaldo. Yeah, to be honest, even if he starts scoring, Ronaldo will probably quickly pop back into the Champions League, just banging a few more pens.
Make that point again. Sign back for Sporting and move up there. We'll see.
Yeah. But anyway, to take the conversation on and to have a bit more fun with this list, I thought, do you know what? Let's rank our three favourites from the list. And as part of this too, and I said this to you, initially I was like, let's not include Ronaldo and Messi because I don't want a Ronaldo versus Messi debate. That's a bit, I don't want to go there. But then I thought, you know what? Actually, it's been done to death and we've done it a few times before. But I thought, actually, no, we can't not include them in this list because they are the greatest European goal scorers and they are an important part of this conversation. So actually, you can include them in your top three, but only one of them. So if you want to include one, fine, but you have to exclude the other so that you can talk about two others. So that's where we're at. Me and Jack will be making a pick between who we preferred, Ronaldo or Messi, and then there will be two other names on this list. At number three for me is Ruud van Nistelrooy. I watched a lot of this man, a lot of him. Reporting, obviously going to United games, just on TV every week. And I'd say first and foremost, like there is going to be a slight English Premier League bias here when I make my picks because this
don't
is
worry,
what
I'll,
I saw.
I'll cover you.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen, for example, as much of Del Piero through his career as I have of Ruud van Nistelrooy because I watched Ruud van Nistelrooy pretty much every week for Man United. And then even when he went to Real Madrid, was able to, you know, keep track with what he was doing. Anyway, what he did at Man United was absolutely absurd. I was there at Old Trafford when he scored against Fulham, picked up the ball on the halfway line, dribbled it past the whole team and slotted it into the far corner.
Yeah.
But that isn't really what Van Nistelrooy was about. And that's what made that goal even more special. Van Nistelrooy, for me, probably the best box finisher I've ever seen. He was so prolific, man. Like, he was so prolific and so aggressive and concise in his finishing. He wasn't missing. Like, United would die for a player like Van Nistelrooy now to have someone that was that ruthless in front of goal. Whether it's head, whether it's a tap-in, whether it's a volley, or whether he was just making a bit of room for himself to smash one home. Van Nistelrooy was just absolutely different level for a while. And there was a period where he had David Beckham delivering the ball for him too, which obviously helped a lot. He had all sorts of immense combinations that he played with throughout his career, which undoubtedly helped him climb up that list. But when I was going through it and I was trying to think what sets these guys apart for me, like what did I love to see? Van Nistelrooy just kept coming into my, I kept remembering the sorts of goals he scored and when he arrived at Man United, the sort of impact he had. But then further than that, obviously he had a pretty high profile exit from Manchester United. It wasn't a happy ending for Ruud van Nistelrooy at Man United. But then beyond that moment, he ends up leaving and goes on to join Real Madrid. Basically, he had a fallout of Alex Ferguson, for those that don't know. Went on, joined Real Madrid, and was just brilliant. I don't know if what even my favourite trait of him. When I think of what I loved the most, it was like his quick finishing, his quick decision-making, whether it was a volley or just the ball would bounce at him in a strange way and he would somehow angle his body to get his shot away, always on target. He was different class. Loved watching him.
Yeah, no, I can appreciate that. I think that those kind of pure poacher finishing strikers, and look, you could probably throw Pippo Inzaghi into the same kind of category, right? He was, you know, a pure penalty box killer. That's basically what we're talking about here. And yes, I think it's fun to think about that goal from Van Nistelrooy now, at least, because I can not be hurt by it in real time. But it was so out of character. And I think that's really interesting to kind of think that when you're maybe most iconic, or at least one of your most iconic goals is actually nothing like the rest of the goals you scored, it's a really interesting kind of place to be. But he was terrifying. I remember being terrified of him. And that's maybe the most interesting thing there, right? He's, you know, those strikers that put the fear of God into your heart when you're playing against them. Van Nistelrooy was exactly that player. And I remember
coming up against him later on when Fulham played Hamburg, not personally, obviously, but, you know, Fulham playing him, and he came on in the last couple of minutes for Hamburg when they were looking for a goal that would have sent them through to the final and Fulham out of the Europa League in 2010. And just been like, well, he's just going to score. Mm. He's going to score. There's absolutely no doubt whatsoever that he's going to score. And he didn't, thankfully. But just that kind of fear was a testament, I think, to the player that he was. He probably wasn't at that point, but the player that he was in his prime, there was almost nothing you could do to stop him.
Yeah, exactly that. And in terms of like a pure goal scorer, that was Van Nistelrooy. And like when I was a kid, I was obviously a striker, and that was the sort of player that I would have modelled myself on. I mean, Van Nistelrooy came too late for me to do that personally. But as a kid, you know, I would watch like Andy Cole, and he was just like, he was like a poacher. He would nick everything around the box, and he'd stick it in the back of the net no matter what. But Van Nistelrooy had a bit more to his game than that, and he could score from a few different ways, and it, just brilliant. But number two is a completely different forward that I didn't actually think I would have as high as this, but the more I thought about who I've enjoyed watching from that list and what sets them apart, I ended up putting Thierry Henry in at number two. Now, in terms of an instinctive goal scorer, a typical number nine, that's not Thierry Henry, is it? But what Thierry Henry did is he redefined what a goal scorer and a centre forward could be, because nobody else played like Thierry Henry. When he came into English football, you know, he was extremely fast, extremely skillful, and had a way to feel the ball that other players just simply didn't have. And they certainly couldn't, if they did have that skill and they were like a natural winger, they didn't have the goal scoring capabilities to match that Thierry Henry did. He transformed football. He changed the way that kids would play football. You think of all these players now that are considered wide forwards. Didn't really exist too much before Thierry Henry. And so now you get, say, Marcus Rashford or someone, for example. Kylian Mbappe is obviously the prime example, who's the most like Thierry Henry you're probably ever going to get. Like, Thierry Henry has kind of made it possible for those guys to be that, because otherwise they would have been a winger or they'd have been a striker. But Thierry Henry made it clear that you could be both, and you could rack up assists, but you could also rack up goals, and you could also take people on. You could thrill fans as well as getting inside the box and scoring the scruffy goals as well as the beautiful curlers into the corner. Like, he was absolutely magnificent. Like, I was lucky early on in my journalism career. I had a job that I was literally Arsenal reporter. I went to every Arsenal game for two seasons when they were at Highbury. So I saw so much of Henry. And, oh, mate, it was an absolute joy to watch this guy. Like, he was genius. He was an absolute genius. And when it comes to the Champions League, and I contemplate, like, how good was he? What could he do? You know, this is a guy
that all-timer of the performance against Real Madrid at the Bernabeu, isn't there?
Absolutely. There's that. And obviously, I primarily remember him for Arsenal, and a lot of that is of the Premier League, but I tried to come away from that. Went on to Barcelona, mate, and he's like, you know, he's got eight goals in the Champions League for Barcelona. So I'm not saying like that defined his Champions League career or anything. But to go from Monaco to Arsenal and end up at Barcelona over the period of like 15 years. Oh, he was just a great, great footballer, and probably still would be. If you could get Thierry Henry in some boots now and stick him in the same position, he'd probably be able to do it better than most people can still do it. So he only makes number eight in the all-time goal scoring list of European legendary goal scorers. But for me, he's in at number two.
You add to, you know, that you talk about the Barcelona bit, and part of that is obviously he won the Champions League. That's the bit at Barcelona which matters. Yes, the eight goals are important, but he lifted the trophy. And part of that was that move to Barcelona felt like the natural step in the kind of completion of his legacy in many ways. And I think you're completely right. He completely changed the game. We wouldn't have wide forwards without him. And also, he also taught loads of people that it's just okay to handball like the ball in the box and just get away with it and score. So that was
here
cool.
Here he is, Mr. Ireland.
He changed the rules of the game. You've got to respect someone who can just do what they want, change the rules of the game.
You can't forget, Caddy. You're allowed, mate. A painful moment in your football watching life. It was tough.
I did want him to become the Ireland manager recently because I was like, you know what, go and here's the redemption arc. Let's have it. But alas, it didn't come to pass.
He owes you a lot that.
Exactly, he does owe us it.
Would he be welcome? Not sure. At number one, am I going Messi? Am I going Ronaldo? I'm going Ronaldo, mate.
Of course you are.
I'm looking here at goal scorers. I'm not judging the greatest player of all time. I'm judging my favourite goal scorer of all time. And my favourite goal scorer of all time in Europe is Cristiano Ronaldo. It's absolutely unbelievable how this guy transformed himself and got better and better and better and continued to be so consistent that he is the highest scoring goal scorer we've ever seen in this competition. At Man United, when he came through, and he would, honestly, I can so clearly remember a couple of the games that I went to watching Ronaldo when he first joined Man United. And he was obviously so young and raw, and he would do things and you were like, I can't tell if this lad is amazing or useless, because he would try all these tricks and some of them would come off. He would literally do four step overs and run out of space and the ball go out for a goal kick. His teammates would get frustrated with him. And this is why I'm so impressed by him, because he obviously had a talent that United were going to nurture, but he just became so, so strong in every single area of his goal scoring. So at first, of course, there's the fact that he can run at someone, do a double step over, cut inside, smash it hard as he likes, straight into the back of net. We can all picture that goal right now that Ronaldo scored umpteen times before. Something I forget is just how good at heading Cristiano Ronaldo became. The amount of headers he began to score, I just did not see that coming from the guy that Man United had initially signed.
Well, he wasn't that player. It's such a reasonable thing to assume, because he was a wiry winger who loved to get at people and loved to sort of play tricks on defenders almost. And there's always those famous stories about Ferguson basically having to be like, stop going around the player twice. Like, once you beat him once, keep going. Don't go around and do him again. It's stupid. It's not what we need. That player to become maybe the best aerial threat that this competition has ever seen is remarkable. To turn from one to the other.
It was immense. Such power that he'd get behind those headers. And then what else I consider in terms of him being my favourite is you think of goal scorers and they usually have a trait for a way that they score goals. And I can't think of anybody that scores penalties like he has, that has scored headers like he has, that has scored goals where he's taken people on and smashed it in, that has arrived at the far post and scored tap-ins, but that has also scored 40-yard free kicks and has also scored from open play from 30, 35 yards. Some of the goals he scored, I think there was one against Porto that he got once. He just absolutely larruped it. And it was absolutely ridiculous.
I love the word larrup. That's great.
It's the only way you could describe it. You were expecting it to go through the net the way that he hit this ball. And it was around the time you were like, oh my, like, what is this guy going to become? And he got stronger and stronger and fitter and his mentality became stronger and just unbelievable, mate, in terms of the record that he built up over time. Between 2003 to 2022, almost 20 years of Champions League football.
Almost.
Unbelievable. And for Man United, Real Madrid and Juventus, three of the biggest clubs ever in the world of football, He's been there and done it. He got 21 goals for Man United. He got 105 goals for Real Madrid, 14 for Juve. Don't forget, when he went to Real Madrid, he was number nine. Do you remember? He was given the number nine shirt. This is really funny to see, actually. When you go on YouTube, you look back at his early Real Madrid goals. He's got this kind of like high-collared Madrid shirt that they had on without a sponsor on it. And the number nine on the back. Looks like a bit like he's playing for a Sunday league team, except it's like at the Bernabeu. And you're seeing the start of Ronaldo as that like number nine. But then obviously does, you know, Benzema comes into the team. Ronaldo becomes a number seven. And as you go through the highlights of Ronaldo's career, just incredible, obviously, like the super goals that he scored and the overheads and stuff, just kind of the icing on the cake. But he gets the, he just gets it for me because in terms of pure goal scoring instincts, nobody wanted it more. And nobody got it more than he did.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult to argue with that. And I think, you know, he's top of this list for a reason. It was pure clinicality in its highest form towards, especially in that Real Madrid spell, because, you know, we talk about Erling Haaland having more than a goal per game. Well, Ronaldo had that at Real Madrid, right? 105 goals and 101 Champions League appearances. That's where we've got to with this. And sometimes it's easy to forget that, you know, yes, would that ratio be higher if he'd played like this for Manchester United when, you know, he started out as a winger, playing a very different role? I think you could probably tie the Real Madrid and Juventus parts together, but that transformation into a centre forward is part of how this, you know, development happened. And it is easy to forget that. I think I can take it onwards from there because my three are very different to your three. And I was putting this list together. And I was a bit sad in some ways that you did throw Messi and Ronaldo back into the mix because it took things away. It took one of my players out. So first, I'd like to apologize to Thomas Müller, who was originally going to be in here and isn't now. And what I've realized when I was putting my list together was what I value the most of anybody or anything in this list. And maybe it's the wrong thing to rank these, you know, players by because it's because we're talking about our favorite. So we're going to do it this way. And I realized what I love is loyalty. And so that I think that makes it easy. So I'll start at three and I'll start with Lionel Messi so they can go back to back. Because, you know, 150 games for Barcelona in the Champions League, 120 goals, it's an incredible scoring record. And, you know, you talk about players who play different positions and do different things. Lionel Messi didn't. He did one thing, but he did it better than anyone I've ever seen. Now, Lionel Messi, you know, straight up is the greatest footballer I've ever watched. I think he's the greatest player to ever play the game. That's fine. But in terms of the way he scored goals, you talk about trademarks, right? You talk about these things that players dial into. That little shift under the left foot on the edge of the box and the whip into the far corner is one of my favorite things to watch. You could watch it over and over again, different goals on repeat and be like, is he just scoring the same thing? But you talk about free kicks and you talk about, well, not so much penalties with Leo Messi.
We'll leave the pens.
We'll leave the penalties alone. But just that ability to create space for yourself. But also, I think why he's third in my list as opposed to top of it is not because I don't think he's, you know, the greatest player here. It's because I think the PSG move like physically hurt me. I'm not even a Barcelona fan. And the PSG move hurt me because I remember seeing it and be like, no, I don't want this. I wanted the, and I know that there are caveats and I know that there was not wanting to leave and financials and all of these things that players don't actually have a say on. And interesting, there's a really good video on Tifa at the moment about the kind of illusion of choice for top players and where they actually end up and how back in the 90s or the early 2000s, if you were one of the best players in the world, there'd normally be four or five different offers coming in for you from different places where you could be like, okay, where do I fit? The only place that Leo Messi could really go was PSG. Was they the only ones that thought they were physically able to afford what he wanted to do? And, but I do think that that hurt his legacy in some ways. Now his record for PSG was fine. It was 9 goals in 14 games. But when you look back at it and you think about him as a goal scorer, my head is always him in the Blaugrana stripes, right? And it will be for everybody. But to come away from that, and you know, as we're talking about loyalty and what this means, I loved the way that every goal felt like it meant something massive. And there is an element, I think with some of the players that you've said there, and look, all of them were incredibly talented footballers within their own rights. I'm not trying to take away from that. You know, sometimes it's a bit cold and clinical. And I think when you see these players with the amount of emotion worn on the sleeve and what it means every time the ball hits the back of the net, that matters for me. And not only was Lionel Messi an incredible goal scorer, he was also a great creator. That's not what we're talking about today. But I think that in terms of just that trademark goal and what it meant every single time and what it meant to the fan base, that's why I've got him in here.
Yeah, I get it. Like, I get it. The thing with Messi, and this sounds stupid because he's the second highest goal scorer in this list, is it's not really his goals that
made him
I define
up.
Him by.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just that he's a magician and he's got an ability to carry a football so close to his foot, walk past people like they're not there, in a way that nobody else has ever done. Nobody else has ever played football the way that Messi does. Like Maradona at times, like when you see the way that he dribbled a ball. But yeah, it's pretty much incomparable when you consider Messi's playing style to other people. And, you know, I put Ronaldo in there and talk about the way that he recreated himself, made himself better and better, worked immensely, immensely hard to become better at all these different aspects of football. And I don't think Messi did. I think Messi just continued to do what he did from the age of five, just slightly get better and better at it every year. And probably the only thing that he absolutely mastered every single day of his life was that free kick. Bang, 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 top bag. Top bag. I'll stick that one in the bottom corner just to mix things up. Right, back to the top bag. And like, just that's what I think of Messi. So, yeah, I had to pick one.
You knew what he was going to do, and then you still couldn't stop it.
Yes.
That was what was incredible. But yeah, I mean, I think it was that, you know, that loyalty to Barcelona. And look, they were the best team in the world. So there, it comes with a caveat on that, obviously. But that really kind of stood out for me as a moment. He never felt like someone who was going to shift onwards. And I think, yeah, that goes back to that PSG thing and why it hurt. It always felt like he'd be there forever and he would be there until he wound up his career. And the fact that wasn't allowed to happen,
yeah,
I think is one of the hardest, you know, the hardest things to swallow and why maybe he's not higher. Second in my list was Alessandro Del Piero. Now, again, a player who played for Juventus for almost his entire career. He had some early spells at Padova and then he obviously went down to Australia later on. I caught kind of the tail end of Del Piero's career, the last 5-6 years of it. And there was a very different player to the player that I think started out and who kind of burst onto the scene at Juventus as part of that generation that overtook from Viali and Baggio. And I think that there was a lot of pressure on his shoulders. He came in as a youngster, wasn't expected to necessarily be in the first team straight away and was thrust in through an injury crisis and just took everything in his stride. And Del Piero as a kind of person is, I think, an incredible guy. Like he seems to come across incredibly well. You think you see the spell that he spent down in Australia and he was just beloved. But, you know, someone who often put himself second, I think was what was cool about Del Piero. He was an incredible goal scorer and the kind of, he was Juventus for such a long period of time. And you talk about him and I think it's impossible almost not to put him in the same breath as Francesco Totti, right? For Roma, where the two, they came through almost at the same time, stayed at their respective clubs for almost their entire careers in Del Piero's case and his entire career in Totti's case. And sort of brought through this new wave, changed Italian football from an era of Catenaccio and very, very defensively orientated games to this kind of wild exacerbation of number 10s. Now, Totti was probably more of a heart on his sleeve player, but Del Piero, what it meant and how it kind of fell for him on top of the way that he just scored every type of goal and his work rate, his ability, but also that kind of versatility to sit behind and be like, okay, sometimes I have to take a back seat here and sometimes I have to change my game to adapt to others. What he did for Italy as well, you know, obviously never really was given that number nine shirt, never really given the guy, but then goes on to score the winning goal, or in the semi-final against Germany, the clinching goal, if you were one of the most iconic goals in World Cup history, I think. For him to go and win a trophy at the end of all of that, and for the two of them to do it together, him and Totti, incredible. And that you kind of read stuff about him now, and you look back, and if you haven't gone back and sort of rewatched the aspects of Del Piero's career and what he did, I think it's an incredible thing to do. But you talk about, you know, how people respected him and how people loved him. You know, we're talking about great players on this list. You know, Raul said he was the best player in the history of Italian football. Maradona basically was like, I would have him over Zinedine Zidane every day because he feels the game in his soul. Del Piero was the best Italian footballer, said Ryan Giggs. Everyone loved Del Piero. And that period where Juventus were relegated for, you know, reasons outside the players' control and the Calciopoli scandal and all of this, he stayed and he brought Juventus back. Even in the twilight of his career, when that moment where he could have gone, oh, could go and win five or six more trophies, he said, a true gentleman never leaves his lady. And he brought Juve back to the top table before he departed. Just there's something incredibly special about that.
Yeah. I did have a soft spot for Del Piero. And actually, the first ever, maybe the only ever, foreign football shirt that I owned was a Juve one, a Del Piero Juve one from 1998. It was one that was the Sony sponsor. And, you know, back, yeah, end of the 90s, like, people didn't really wear many, like, it's not like now where you get everybody wearing kits from all over the world. It didn't happen that much. But I can remember really wanting that Juve kit and that Juve team from that period. It was Del Piero that was the guy for me. That stood out. So, yeah, I can totally see why you might have.
Even now, when someone says Juventus, and the person I picture in my head in the Juve shirt is Del Piero.
That's what they could sometimes do with him, mate. They could still do with him at times.
They could definitely do with. They could definitely do with a prime Del Piero right now. It takes us on to my final one, which is Raul, who is obviously fifth in this list, which is an incredible achievement in its own sense. But I think that, you know, obviously in that early 2000s era, as kind of Spanish football was not necessarily growing in popularity, but I think given more exposure, especially in the UK, in the Revista de la Liga era, as we call it, a lot of people were like, oh, cool, we'll go and see Real Madrid because the Galacticos, we'll go and see Ronaldo, we'll go and see Beckham, we'll go and see Zidane, Roberto Carlos. And I remember being like, cool, I'm going to watch Real Madrid a bit. And I had a Real Madrid black Siemens kit. And I remember going to a shop and be like, can you put Raul on the back of it? And they were like, what? And I went and watched these games because everyone was interested. My dad was interested. My uncles were interested watching these Real Madrid games with this Galactico team. Yeah. And being like, I love this number seven. And you talked about the fact that Cristiano Ronaldo came into Real Madrid as the most expensive player ever at that point. And he was obviously like, can I have my seven shirt? They were like, nah, Raul has the seven. And I think that is a testament to just how loved and important he was. And I think if you ask Madridistas who were alive or watching in that era and are still here today, they will say to you that Raul remains the preeminent legend of the club, the symbol of what it means to be Madrid. And there's that picture of him, isn't there, in the cape with the trophy and sort of like tears streaming down his face. He was heart and soul Real Madrid. Now, he was an incredible goal scorer. And look, the early part of his career, again, it wasn't alive for, but you go back and you watch it, and he was this incredibly exciting striker with a work rate. He reminds me a bit of Luis Suarez in that early part of his career when you go back and watch it. That kind of pressure that's constantly on defenders, forcing mistakes. And he came in and he replaced a club legend in Butragueño, right? He was the man who basically heralded the end of the era of the Quinta del Buitre and that whole part of Real Madrid. And there was a point where you go, oh, he's taken one of the club's all-time legends out of the picture by being this busy and this intelligent. And it comes back to that word, intelligence. Raul, I think, there's a famous Sierra quote on him that says he was an 8.5 in everything. He wasn't a 10 in anything. He was an 8.5 in everything. I think that does him an injustice because it makes him found like a kind of all-round player that sort of worked hard and did a bit. I think Raul might be the most intelligent footballer I've seen maybe ever. What he did in terms of adapting his game, starting off as the kind of guy who replaced Butragueño, then coming into this era with the Galacticos and being like, cool, I will sacrifice myself so I play further back behind R9. I will change my game to adapt to everybody else and I will keep the entire thing ticking because my link-up play is gorgeous. I have maybe the best touch of anyone here. With all of these players signed for the most money, Luis Figo said he's the greatest Spanish player to ever play the game. I think what he brought to a team, on top of all the usual kind of, yes, he scored an incredible amount of goals. He was the top scorer in Europe ever when he went past Di Stefano. It was obviously then usurped by four different people, but he was on top of this for a while. And to come into this kind of space where he'd been let go from Atleti's academy at like 15 because they were like, you're not good enough, joined Real Madrid and became the club's most iconic legend, perhaps. I mean, it's an incredible story, but just as a footballer, he could do everything. And the one thing, we talk about trademarks, we'll come back to it one more time. Raul's trademark was chipping the keeper.
It was.
That in itself is just vibes all over the shop. Like, and there's a great interview, like him and Draxler became friends when he went off to Schalke. He didn't leave Real Madrid, by the way, because he wanted to. They literally were like, you have to go now. So he went to Schalke to learn from Felix Magath, who he thought was a good manager, which, I mean, I disagree with, but there is an element of like, okay, cool, he's going to do something different. He became really good friends with Julian Draxler. And Draxler once said to him, he was like, what, you know, what do you do with keepers running out on you? He was like, 90% of the time, just chip it. You never do that. And apparently Draxler was like, I looked at him and I was like, I don't think he understands that not everyone can just do that. And I think that's probably a testament to exactly how good Raul was. It's just immense. And the player, you know, go for the Galacticos, you stay for Raul. Because that's how good he was, and that's how special he was, and that's what he meant to Real Madrid.
Perfect, mate. A lovely walk down memory lane there for us. Hope people enjoyed that. A very different ranking this week.
Absolutely, absolutely. Right, in part three, we got a quick help to give. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Ranks FC. It's time for part three and a little bit of guru wisdom.
Guru wisdom, guru wisdom, guru wisdom.
Thank you, boys. Last week, we helped Mitch out. Mitch has come back to us with some answers. What's Mitch picked, Dean?
Yeah, he was really grateful for the help. He says, right, I am for sure going to join the Roma crew. He's going to be a Roma fan from here. He's also decided, Jack, that he's going to join you in becoming a Real Betis fan.
Nice.
You see, mate, Real Betis just announced, well, they are announcing a friendly in San Diego against
at
Man
Snapdragon,
United.
Against United.
At Snapdragon.
Like about 2 weeks after you'll get there. I was very excited for you.
It is. Probably going to be about $150 a ticket or something silly, but I'll try and get there. And his team from France is Lille, which I think I kind of threw in, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. That was a late pick.
That was a late pick that was kind of off the top of my head. So he's gone for that. He said he's still thinking about the Bundesliga a little bit more, thinking about whether he could cheer on Union Berlin.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sure Mitch will get back to us when he decides what he's doing in the Bundesliga. This one's from Ellis. I got this on Twitter. He said, hi, mate. I hope this message finds you well. I'm looking for a Premier League club to support. Was wondering if you and Dean could help me choose one on Ranks. Fun. I'm an American who recently moved to the UK and I'm staying until May. I've tried supporting a few Premier League clubs in the past, but haven't really been able to commit. I'm a fan of AC Milan, Mallorca, Leverkusen, Monaco, and my local club, Real Salt Lake. I enjoy parity and I strongly dislike clubs who win the league every year. I love a club with a big veteran centre-back who scores a lot of goals. I don't particularly care if the football I'm watching is pretty, as long as the players are bought in. I also appreciate a club with a nice kit. Some things I enjoy outside of football are musical theatre, roller coasters, and skiing. I hope that with this information, you guys can find a good club for me. I mean, I know you were joking, but like actually, turning Ellis into a Fulham fan isn't the worst idea I've ever heard. Big American centre-back veteran in the middle of it, although he doesn't score that many goals, our sweet Tim Ream.
He doesn't.
But I was thinking about this in a funny way. I thought it was a good one.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to recommend anyone that isn't Fulham here. Did he say which part of England he's staying in?
He hasn't. So
I think that's quite key to it, because I want him to at least... I'm going to assume it's London.
Yeah, I think it's a safe bet.
I mean, most people, if he's here till May, he must be studying or something. And I think most people would probably end up in London just because there are the most options there. So as a response to that, I'm going to pick a London club. But if it's not London that you're in, then just pick a team that's close to you to actually go and get there, or at least get a feel for that club. I do feel that that's really important. If it's London, then I'm absolutely not going to pick anyone apart from Fulham off as the first pick. But if you don't want to pick Fulham because you want some hope of glory down the line, then the only team that I can recommend is Tottenham.
Okay. This is a second Spurs fan you've pushed.
It was the roller coasters thing.
Yeah, I mean, it is a roller coaster.
It's a roller coaster. And
they don't win the league. They don't win the league every year. So
don't win the league every year. It's definitely a roller coaster. They don't have a veteran centre back, but they do have Romero, who's a hell of a centre back. And they have emerging, probably the next great centre back in Van de Ven. And that should become the best central defensive partnership in the league. There are no links to Milan or Mallorca or Real Salt Lake or Leverkusen that I can think of. But if you want a chance of
glory...
They're
in the same kind of category, though, Tottenham, I think, as I would probably put Leverkusen most of the time, not this year, obviously,
yeah.
And Monaco.
There's the chance of something, you know, and it probably won't happen. This will probably end in disappointment. But you're getting to support a team that... building a philosophy, they're going to be signing some exciting players. You've got a manager you're actually going to like, and you can enjoy watching his press conferences as well as his football. You've got some nice players there, and a hell of a stadium to go and visit. You know, if you're going to pick a stadium to go to in London at the moment, and you're not chasing the title, and so you're not going to be at the Emirates, then the only other place to go is Tottenham.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. A suggestion.
But if you go to Fulham, you can come and have a beer with me and Jack.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're more than welcome down the Hammersmith End anytime. Although the Guinness machine is gone now, so I have less beers at halftime.
And the pale ale's gone as well, so I don't drink at halftime. But
so you can just come and have some waters with me and Dean at halftime if you want. Thank you very much to Ellis. We have one already set up for next week, but if you'd like to get into this segment, if you'd like to be on the list, then do drop us a message, Twitter or Instagram or on the Patreon as well. And with that, I think it's probably time for us to call it a day. So all that's left for me to do is say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
That was fun, mate. Thank you.
I very much enjoyed it. Thank you for coming up with the idea. I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. We'll be back first thing tomorrow morning with a Champions League review and looking back at all the action of the Champions League this week. So make sure you're locked in for that one. Enjoy the games across the course this week, and we'll see you very shortly. Take it easy, gang. Peace. Final seconds of the game. A chance to score, and the chance has gone begging. If your business's commerce platform keeps missing the target on golden opportunities, get the MVP you deserve. Get Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whether you're a garage entrepreneur or IPO ready, Shopify is the only tool that you need to start, run, and grow your business without the struggle. Shopify puts you in control of every sales channel. So whether you're selling signed football boots from Shopify's in-person POS system or you're vending vintage shirts on Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform, you are covered. And once you've reached your audience, Shopify has the internet's best converting checkout to help you turn them from browsers to buyers. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is truly a global force, powering Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen,
and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across over 170 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ranks, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ranks to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/ranks.